what is called God. But to me, the very fact that a thing called death exists to terminate a person's life, that makes me believe in something called God, in an intelligence called God. I don't think anybody else would have thought of that. Nobody else could have conceived of a thing called death. If only death were not there, imagine all these crooks living forever and ever and ever. Terrible. The world would be, it's a bad place already, but a terrible place to live in. Gone around where? We don't know what, I mean, if I'm sure I'm going to live forever and ever and ever, I don't know what I would do. Joke. Dreadful thing. So it's a marvelous thing that there is a thing called death in our life. Fantastic. And also terminating all our sufferings and pains, unhappiness. Fantastic. Whenever I think of this death, I say, there must be a God. There must be an intelligence which is far superior to any human person. No human person could have invented this death. When it is there, we take advantage of it. We kill each other. Like I believe Dr. Alexis Carroll said that he saw the ability of blood to coagulate itself. He says, I didn't put it there. I saw it and I was amazed. The self-sealing ability of the arteries and veins. He says, fantastic. And when I saw it, he says, I couldn't believe that thing like that is possible. So that is there. And even when we kill one another, it's only a recognition of the principle which is already in existence. That we could not have invented at all. So this Yama is considered the controller, the governor, the restrainer, the limiter, the regulator of life, introducing breaks into it, and this Chitragupta goes and tells him. You know why they, whoever it is, the rishis, introduce this concept? There is a mysterious, there is a mystery, which is not easy to understand nor easy to explain. This personality, which continues embodiment after embodiment, incarnation after incarnation, this continues from one incarnation to another incarnation. And in this embodiment, in this incarnation, let's say it has been mostly vicious, murdering, looting, doing all sorts of fantastic, terrible things. Though it perhaps also did some good to somebody, maybe to his wife and children. You mentioned Hitler. Even he must have done some good to some people. It's not possible for a man to be totally evil, for a person to be totally evil. He does some good to somebody, some people, and he does a lot of evil to others. And this personality leaves that embodiment and goes on. With all these recorded somewhere in the etheric double, what determines what his experiences in the present incarnation are going to be. In other words, if this person is to experience the reactions of all his evil actions, he's finished in 3 days. And yet, we are not subjected to too much of suffering. There is always a silver lining somewhere running in the... at least, you know, somebody goes on whipping you and he falls asleep in the middle. Right. Somebody goes on torturing you and he falls asleep. What... is there... I've forgotten the word, Sanskrit words, but I remember the story. It seems a king was strolling along the beach with his ministers, and one of the ministers was a super genius with psychic powers, clairvoyance, and all sorts of things. And as they were walking along the beach, there was a big breaker. And it washed ashore a skull, a human skull. The king picked it up. They sat down. The king put it on his lap. And looked at this minister and said, "You have got all sorts of powers. Can you read, you know, what is written on its head? I don't know if you have also the same belief. They say that all your fate is written on your skull somewhere. On your forehead, you know, something you have. Huh? Something like that. And so he looked at the minister and said, "Can you read what this man's fate was while he was alive? What is written on it?" And this minister turned it around and said, "Yes." And there is a beautiful sloka, verse. I remember only the last bit. He would be born in misery. He was born blind, he was deaf and dumb, and etc. He was born poor and suffered all his life. His life was short-lived. Mm-hmm. Suffered from hunger, disease, all sorts of things. And eventually he would drown and die. And the last bit is kinchit bhogam bhavishyati. That is, there will be a little happiness. That's all. Not even to him or in his life. Kinchit bhogam bhavishyati. Kinchit means a little. Bhogam, pleasure. Bhavishyati will happen. That's the exact translation. Kinchit bhogam bhavishyati. And the king was tickled and he looked at the minister and said, "What? How? When?" Because you said he is born blind and he is deaf and he is poor, poverty stricken and disease ridden and you know, suffering, starving and dying in very, very young in the sea. What is kinchit bhogam bhavishyati? The minister said, "It's quite obvious that his skull should mount your lap. That's the only..." That is the only good fortune that the soul had been allotted. That after the fellow died, that his skull should be on a royal lap. Isn't that marvelous? This, nobody has been able to really explain. There may be no reason at all, there may be no explanation at all. But yet, your brain, your mind, your intellect demands an explanation. And so they conjured up a sort of court, divine court, majesty, yama and all sort of thing. It may merely be, that is the orthodox teaching, but it may merely be that the personality with all these impressions of past actions, stored in the mind, in the chitta. Worlds keeps whirling around in the next embodiment And as it keeps whirling around, it is able at appropriate moments to attract appropriate experiences, the proper experiences. That may be the Yama, that may be the Chitragupta, we don't know, we have no idea. It may be the that these are very graphically portrayed in the form of all this God and the Yama and the Chitragupta and so on. So out of this Sanchita, the soul or this personality, this computer, whirls around, carrying with it the subtle impressions left by all these actions, good and evil. And another tricky factor. Once this body has been disconnected, once the chitta disconnects itself from this body, how does it get into the next one? When, where, etc., etc.? This is a big question. Now it's coming up into everybody's attention because of this abortion stuff. There are as many theories concerning this as there are thinkers. In what is known as the Upanishads themselves, there are a few different theories. In the Upanishads, this problem is dealt with not in a terribly detailed manner in the Upanishads, but there are a few theories. There is one theory that this personality is born thrice. Once it takes birth in the father, then it takes birth in the mother, and then it takes birth in the outside world. And that's, I think, quite common and simple. But let's take an uncommon example. It's terribly interesting, beautiful. The uncommon doctrine is that the whole story of evolution is repeated at every birth. That is, when it is time for this body to be dropped, the personality drops this body and goes away. It goes away, it hangs in the cloud, as part of the cloud. It has no size, no form, no shape, nothing. And then, after a little while, it's a beautiful description, graphic description. So please take the graphic description as a graphic description. And it falls down with one of those raindrops onto the earth. It may be this earth, it may be another, surface of some other planet. It falls down and gets mixed up with the earth. That is, water remains water. The spirit that was in that water drop enters into the earth, as it were. That means, you were a mineral a few years ago. Not a very pleasant thought, but then, take it for what it is worth. You were a mineral. Then, staying there as a mineral, you entered into the root of a plant and became a plant. You were a plant. And you grew as a plant, as a fruit, or as a lettuce. And that vegetable was picked and eaten by a man, and you entered into him. and then became his seed. That seed was transferred to the woman. And so you were transferred, pushed around from there to here. All the time you somehow, the me somehow, traveling right through all this. And then you begin to grow. When you started growing, you were swimming, fish. This theory of evolution, that we were all aquatic creatures once, 55 years ago. Not once, 20 billion years ago, 55 years ago, in your case, much later, 25 years ago. You were a fish, swimming. And then you were pushed out. I don't know, this may not be the right time to discuss all that. In India, there is the theory of God incarnating 10 times. First God incarnated as a fish, and then God incarnated as a tortoise, then as a pig, and all sorts of things. All that happened to you in this birth. First you were a fish, and then when you were first thrown out, you were as good as a tortoise. And then you were, if you ask your mother or grandmother, you'll tell you, very much like a pig, wallowing in your own dirt, filth, sort of thing. All that therefore happened in this birth. And all the time that computer was whirling, looking for the right opportunity to draw to itself the appropriate experiences. It is not possible for all the potentialities and the faculties that have been built into that personality to be expressed and experienced in one short lifetime. Which is the reason why even your brain cells are not all used. There are billions of what one might still call potentialities, which lie completely hidden, disused, unused, undiscovered. And you are born with it, you live without it, and you die with it. Is that right? You are born with all that, but you live without all that, and you die with it. Carrying it over, hopefully, the next birth, it is possible that some of those potentialities may become manifest. That's the reason, one of the foremost reason why I think that we will all be reborn as some animal. Because then some more potentialities become manifest in a dog. Some more potential in a monkey. So that you can climb a tree without fear. Isn't that marvelous? You cannot even climb a tree without trembling. The monkey does it. So probably the climbing potentiality comes into operation in your next birth. And then you are born as a dog, then you are born as a sheep, and so on. You are able to grow your own wool. Instead of robbing somebody else's wool and making a nice sweater and say, oh, isn't it beautiful? As you say, isn't this beautiful? The sheep says, oh, you took it from me. So all these potentialities may one day become fully experienced and made manifest. That Sanchita is all there, it's quite simple. This is the theory. The Sanchita is like a treasure, and from it, just a little bit is allotted to each birth. And again, whether one sees it this way or not, biologists are beginning to believe that in each one of those cells of that body, there is a clock built in. the biological time clock. And those cells know how long that body should live. And you cannot make it live longer and nor kill it faster. The biological time clock being quite different from the ordinary clocks that you have, in the calendars you have. Each cell has got its own lifetime written on it. And then also, this is quite plain, that there are inherited tendencies, rheumatism, tuberculosis, which are hidden in that body, which are brought forward, brought with the body, with the cells of the body, at birth. And they begin to manifest in their own time, in their own way.
That's a physiological predisposition.
Yes.
But it doesn't necessarily have to happen depending on...
Exactly. Happen on the me. But it is a physiological disposition. And again, why is it... After all, you see, the physiological characteristics are inherited from the parents, let's say. But this body was given by the parents. I didn't bring it from my past birth. But then, it is because of its psychological disposition or the spiritual, the disposition built into it, that it chose those parents. If I had to have, if I had to suffer from rheumatism, for instance, I choose as parents they who have this trouble, so that it is easy for me to, I don't have to go and acquire rheumatism afresh, it's there already. That's why I suggested right in the beginning. Always, all through, ask yourself, what have I got to do with this? What is me? What is this me that is involved in all this? All these are physical laws. That the body was born of so-and-so parents who had these and who transmitted some congenital problems. What has I to do with this? Why does the me come into the picture at all? That's something which one has to constantly remember. And that part of the karma, which is allotted, so to say, to this embodiment, which has been appropriated for this embodiment, that is determined at the time, tricky, at the time the me determines the identification process. When the fetus or the baby acquires an identity for itself. When that is, nobody knows. Everybody knows. You can put it either way. No. When the jiva identifies itself with that particular embodiment, when that is, either you can say nobody knows, or you can say everybody knows, or everybody guesses. You think it is 6 months, somebody thinks it's something, I think it is even before you, I think it is even before my parents got married. No one knows. He also gave all the theories and left it at that. Make up your mind. Because I don't think it's possible to evolve a dogma out of it. Nobody knows. Because, you see, the problem again here is, consciousness is consciousness and matter is matter. The linking is unreal. Huh? When you see this unreality of this linking of consciousness with matter, then the rest is all theory. Why not appreciate more theories? But this much is clear, that once that decision is made on the material plane, that decision becomes inviolable. You are born with that karma, and that is called prarabdha, a karma that has begun. Prarabdha merely means commenced. Prarabdha merely means commenced. It has begun. What has begun has to be gone through. Sanchita is what is still dormant. And I'm beginning to feel that it's not as if that all this Sanchita is hanging around the cloud somewhere there. It may be all in your own brain. Unawakened, dormant. And possibly that is the reason why the yogis are said to be capable of working out all their Sanchita also, by activating all these dormant inner faculties. Then what you and I are doing now, egotistically, not recognizing the fact that it is that consciousness that is experiencing all this, and that it is the ego, the mind and the body that function here. All the functioning is done by the ego, the mind, the body, the ego sense, the mind, the body. And all experiences belong to the consciousness. Without the consciousness, no experience is possible. But then suddenly this me jumps up and says, I am doing this and I am experiencing this. As long as this me is there, the ball returns. And every action that is performed leaves an impression and creates an impulse. And this is a fresh thing which keeps it all going. One who understands this is able to live an enlightened and wise life. How is that so? Perhaps we can deal with it in a few minutes. What is the use of all this? It can serve us two useful purposes. One, when I am subjected to pain or adversity or misfortune, which includes all dishonor and disrespect, etc., all that, I am able to look on it with utter equanimity. Assuming or knowing, preferably knowing or at least assuming, that I must have deserved. I must deserve this somehow. This is some kind of balancing. This is my karma. This is my karma, not in a dejected, morose, no. This is my karma. I must need this in order to that some imbalance in me may be restored to balance, may be corrected. So that when I am subjected to misfortune pain, suffering. I am looking within rather than outside. And I cease blaming other people for my misfortunes, other people for my suffering, pain. So that when I cease blaming others, I cease judging others and hating others. Right? So, to me, that's a very good thing. I don't need anything more. I have a feeling also that the famous saying of Jesus on the cross, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. I have a feeling that he was referring to this. Huh? They don't know what they do. This is my karma I have to do. I have to be on the cross. And they think they are killing me, foolish people. Forgive them. This is my karma. Why blame them at all? It's nothing. Nobody to be blamed for whatever it is happening. Nobody need be blamed for what is happening. It is my karma. So, the person who understands this law of karma does not blame others, does not despair, and does not succumb to pain and suffering, does not lose his balance when there is pain and suffering. On the contrary, his balance is restored.
Similar to saying it's God's will. Same thing.
But while saying God's will, you still think, well, you know, I really don't deserve it, but it's God's will. But here I'm saying, I need it. If you change it to God's grace, I think I'll appreciate it even more. If you altered it to God's grace, that's probably even more closer to the truth. It's a pure balancing. My personality, my soul, or whatever it is, must need this somehow. That's why I have it. That this may merely be settling of past account, balancing. Then I do not react. If I do not accept it, then I begin to fight with you now, creating a fresh karma, agami karma. Therefore, it promotes peace of mind, harmony, and preserves harmony in society. Therefore, eventually it turns our gaze, our vision, our attention upon ourselves to try to see what it is that performs actions in life and what it is that experiences pain, pleasure, etc.